I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. On this edition of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, women, work, and the politics of pregnancy. Only 3 states in the U.S. mandate paid maternity leave. America is the only industrialized nation that does not guarantee maternity leave across the board. American women often still have to choose between starting a family or pursuing a career. 40 years after the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was passed, what has changed for women at work? In this age of hashtag MeToo, baby bump selfies, and leaning in, is the conversation around work and motherhood finally changing? We're joined by Michelle Chen, a contributing writer to The Nation magazine. Midday Culture Connections gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall, and today it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth made headlines recently when she announced that she would be expecting her second child this spring. She will become the first sitting senator to give birth. While her announcement might be an historic first for Congress, Senator Duckworth is one of 25 million working mothers in the United States. The hashtag MeToo movement has given voice to women from assembly lines to corner offices around the persistence of sexual harassment and assault. While working mothers with children under the age of 18 account for a third of the women in the labor force, many women face workplace discrimination based on pregnancy. More than 30,000 claims of discrimination were filed with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission between 2010 and 2015. 3,000 claims were filed just last year. New mothers also face obstacles when it comes to breastfeeding. Fewer than 40% of women have adequate break time or access to acceptable nursing facilities on the job, leaving many to fall short of their breastfeeding goals. So today, a look at the politics of pregnancy in the workplace. Do women still have to choose between starting a family and pursuing a career? And what protections are afforded expectant mothers by their employers under the law? If you are or have been an expectant mother in the workplace, what have your experiences been? 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. Our email, midday at wypr.org. And to find us on Twitter, at Midday WYPR. Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland. She joins us on the first Tuesday of every month for Culture Connections. Good to see you, Sherry.
Hi there.
And you are, by the way, a mother.
I am the mother of a 22-year-old.
A very smart and wonderful 22-year-old named Kelsey, who has been a guest on this very program,
yes,
as a matter of fact. And we are also joined on the phone now by Michelle Chen. She's a contributor to The Nation magazine. Michelle's also a contributing editor at Dissent magazine and a contributing writer at In These Times. Michelle, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thanks.
So, Michelle, let me start with you. You wrote a piece in The Nation 2.5 years ago or so about a Supreme Court decision brought by a woman who worked for UPS at the time. Give us a little recap of what that decision entailed and what that case was all about.
Yeah, this was related to kind of arcane law known as the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, and it's a federal law that basically protects women who work when they become pregnant. They're allowed to have a reasonable accommodation at their job. And this is a protected right. It's basically, you know, it's a civil right that you have at work. And in order to qualify, in order to determine the right kind of accommodation, you know, you can, there are a number of different standards that workplaces can apply, but generally speaking, you're supposed to have reasonable accommodation based on your ability to work and, you know, your physical needs at the time. And that can be anything from being able to sit on a stool, you know, while you're on your shift, or being able to take an extra water break every once in a while. Generally, these are not, you know, huge deals, but we find that employers very often will discriminate against women on the basis of pregnancy and then come up with all sorts of excuses as to why they cannot qualify for, you know, a special provision under this Pregnancy Discrimination Act, and it relates back to a whole body of law related to disability law, which has provisions for people with disabilities who work and can get reasonable accommodations if they seek them and if they're justified under the law. And pregnancy, while it might be strange to think of it as a form of disability, that's generally how people, that's sort of the legal avenue into these protections. But so, you know, all other things being equal, if you are pregnant and all you need is an extra stool, there's no reason for your employer to not provide it for you. And by doing so, that's an act of discrimination. And it might force women, for instance, to take off early from work or stop working early during their pregnancy simply because their workplace is so unaccommodating. Might lead them to take unpaid leave, which is something that you don't want if you want to continue making an income. And all you need is a little bit of, you know, extra help at work. So, it's one way that pregnancy can really impair women, not just, you know, physically and stress-wise, but also income-wise as well.
Yeah, and Sherry Parks.
And in this case, the Supreme Court ruled in, you know, she was able to qualify ultimately for this. They ruled 6-3 in favor of Peggy Young.
Michelle, you hit at what I think is an interesting point, is that we don't quite know how to treat pregnancy. At one level, women say, well, you know, it's not an illness. I can still work. But when you get into the law, it's treated as usually a temporary disability. And we don't quite know how to handle it. We don't have a category for something that happens every day to lots of people and isn't, for the most part, a disability until it is.
Yeah. I mean, it really comes down to this sort of pathologizing of a very natural, ordinary thing for women to experience, and that the fact that our workplaces are so hostile to it that they even call it a disability, they have to stick it in this disability category. I mean, that's a whole philosophical debate, but, you know, practically speaking, the idea here is that if you can work, you can work, and you have the flexibility to be able to ask your boss to accommodate you as long as you hold that job. And a lot of people see pregnancy as an excuse not to do that.
Well, and there are larger issues because, I mean, the law says you don't have to disclose that you're pregnant or that you might become pregnant. Employers can't ask you. And yet women report that it gets asked in lots of sneaky ways.
Yeah. The flip side of this is that you don't want to be over-policed while you're pregnant, you know, so it's a very...
Yeah, and sort of at the heart of it is also, and you wrote about this in The Nation, about the it's really a feminist concept that the courts said that basically women don't have to prove to their bosses why they deserve the same right as men. Because if a guy, sprains his wrist and asks his company, or say he works for UPS and he sprains his wrist and says, okay, I can't lift packages that are more than 20 pounds, which is exactly what Peggy Young was asking to do, just simply to be put in a job situation where she wasn't having to lift these really huge packages under her doctor's advice while she was pregnant. And the court basically said it's not up to the person, to the employee, to prove that she's unable to do that for a temporary period of time. It's up to the employer to say, okay, we'll make accommodations for both situations, both the man and the woman.
Yeah. And it's also, it's an interesting reflection of, you know, where the power lies in the workplace, right? When the burden of proof is, the burden of pregnancy and the burden of proof for proving that level of impairment really falls on the worker. And they are workers. If that's the only thing, if her gender is the only thing distinguishing her from her male counterpart, and the levels of ability are otherwise the same, there's really no reason why the burden of proof should be on her to that extent.
And the Supreme Court sent this case back to the Virginia court from whence it originated, and the case was settled. We don't know the amount of the settlement, but the company settled with Ms. Young, and her attorney said that they weren't going to disclose the actual terms, but that the parties had reached an agreement based in part on a new pregnancy accommodation policy put in place by UPS. So maybe it did move the dial. That particular case, which did go all the way to the Supreme Court, you know, move the dial a little bit there. Is there a trend towards cases like this? I mean, since you wrote about this a couple of years ago, have you seen anything happening in terms of workplace discrimination? I mean, we have bills, Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, a co-sponsor of a bill, the Family and Medical Leave Act, allowing people to take time off from work once they've delivered a baby. I mean, we've heard about that, particularly in conjunction with the ACA. But what's your read of the current climate in terms of legislation that is directed towards discriminatory practices in the workplace these days?
There has been a federal push for federal legislation known as the Pregnancy, I believe it's the Pregnancy Fairness Act.
Yeah, the Pregnancy Workers Fairness Act, right.
Yes, yeah, and it would sort of broaden the provisions around the Pregnancy Discrimination Act and basically just create clarity around, you know, what it means to be pregnant at work, the types of accommodations that people can legitimately ask for. And so that would just strengthen that right all around, and it's based on recent rulings in part from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and so that's, you know, a separate sort of civil rights agency. They can bring cases themselves as well, and they do a lot of litigation work that kind of helps to clarify these rights and to defend individual women on a day-to-day basis. And you see laws like this sort of cropping up on the state and local level as well. I believe Illinois has gotten something like this recently, and you know, there's a lot of action in the states, and just like you're seeing with these other things like the minimum wage and paid sick days, there's a lot more momentum on the state level than in Congress right now, which is, you know, obviously setting a pretty low bar if you're comparing yourself to Washington, but a lot of times there's some really good grassroots work that's being done with labor groups, with you know, women's rights groups, human rights commissions, and other folks in government who recognize that they're really, you know, it's not just an issue of fairness and protection, but it's also an issue of economics. I mean, people say that, you know, the more flexible you are in a sensible way towards workers' everyday needs, and that can mean pregnancy, and it can mean, you know, a day or two sick every once in a while. You know, that it's ultimately good for business when people can take the time off they need for themselves without sacrificing income. The Family Medical Leave Act is this provision for unpaid leave, which deals with sort of this wider issue. Pregnancy discrimination kind of falls into, you know, some of the various family-based obstacles that workers face, but you know, paid family medical leave would be the next step. And there are paid leave laws that are in place in some states, and there's a push to have that on the national level. But that would really be for you know, family needs as well as medical needs, and you'd be able to take paid time off from work.
Yeah, of course, paid sick leave, very important issue here in Maryland. In the last session a year ago, the House and Senate here in Maryland passed a paid sick leave bill, which Governor Hogan vetoed, and then they overrode that veto early on in the session this year. And of course, Michelle, before we let you go, you wrote about the fact that these kinds of discriminatory practices at work for people who are pregnant disproportionately affect lower-income workers. You talked about a woman whose job was to decorate cakes at Walmart, and Walmart gave her a hard time when she asked to be accommodated in a fairly reasonable way, pretty small way, at her job. So this is a less of a problem for professional women in the corner offices, you know, who have some leverage with their corporations, perhaps. But it's a huge problem for people who are working for hourly wages.
Yeah, both in asking for leave time and asking for accommodations at work. You know, low-wage workers often meet with more hostility, and, you know, sadly, it's completely ironic, but in a weird way, it makes sense that they'd face the most hardship. I mean, these are people working in the jobs that really need accommodations for pregnancy, right? You're standing all day to register. You know, you're a line cook or something. You know, these are high-stress, physically demanding jobs. farm worker women, right? You know, they very routinely face this obstacle of they can't take time off and still receive pay, so they can't take any time off to take care of themselves without losing income, and they want to stay on the job. They can't get these simple accommodations, just like this, you know, this Walmart worker who got basically, you know, kind of harassed by her employer. And you know, just I believe that over the past decade, the number of pregnancy discrimination charges has increased by over a third, according to federal research on this. So, you know, and that's just a formal complaint, you know, let alone the subsurface, you know, slights and obstacles that people face and never bother to report. So it raises tensions in the workplace, and that's the last thing that pregnant women need. And so hopefully, you know, hopefully if they have better laws, they have something to fall back on.
And the National Partnership for Women and Families found that the most complaints to the EEOC came from healthcare and social assistance, which is a female-dominated industry. And it's interesting because we often pit this as men against women, but in many cases it may be, well, I came back to work or I did this and you should be able to do this. And you pointed out a lot of it is, can you stand for long periods of time? And if you're heavily pregnant, that's a problem.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. All right. Well, Michelle Chen, thank you so much for your time. We got to take a break and let you go, but very much appreciate your work and your time this afternoon. Thanks.
Thanks.
Michelle Chen is a contributing writer for The Nation. She's also a contributing editor at Dissent magazine and a contributing writer at In These Times. She's a co-producer of Asia Pacific Forum on Pacifica's WBAI and Dissent's Belabored podcast. We'll have more of the Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland after a quick break. Love to hear your experience at work, your experience being pregnant while you worked or while you are working currently. 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org to find us in the Twittersphere at Midday WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a conversation about the iconic singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. David Yoffe has written a portrait of one of folk and pop music's most legendary figures. It's called Reckless Daughter. And we'll talk about Joni Mitchell's life and work, and we'll listen to some of her most beloved songs. That's coming up tomorrow for all the Joni Mitchell fans here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Sherry joins us on the first Tuesday of every month. She's an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, and our Twitter handle is at midday WYPR. Let's go to the phones. Melissa in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to share, I recently had twins on December 11th. They were born at 33 weeks because I was diagnosed with a pretty severe form of preeclampsia. And I was very fortunate that my employer would have been extremely accommodating had I asked for an accommodations. I kind of tried to prove that I didn't need any, which probably was detrimental to my own health. But I do want to just comment that I think it's interesting that we've got members in the federal legislative branch who claim to promote family and children and want to expand they want to expand certain rights that are given to families, but then at the same time are trying to make it extremely difficult for women to choose whether they want to expand their family and whether they can expand their family. So there is a lot of tension, I think, between this idea that America is promoting families and then also making it very difficult for women to continue to work after having a family.
That's a really great point, Melissa. The kids are okay? The kids are healthy?
Yeah, but everyone's doing great. We're actually headed to we just parked at our 2-month checkup. So everyone is doing well, thank you.
And how much time are you taking off from work?
I'm taking 12 weeks under FMLA, 9 of which I think will be paid. And then my husband and I discussed before we got pregnant that I would purchase a short-term disability policy. So I ended up, because I had this emergency C-section, getting 8 weeks at 6% of my salary. Mm-hmm. So I'll end up being paid, but that was sort of something that he and I had the foresight to do, which I think a lot of people not necessarily are planning their pregnancy, or they don't think about that in the same way he and I did. I also think that there is an issue that when we refer to pregnancy as a disability, mm-hmm. I mean, I do think the language needs to change when it comes to talking about expanding someone's family. It takes two to expand a family, and yet women are considered, quote, disabled, and the burden of working, the physical burden falls on them, the emotional burden of proving that we can do it while we're at work. I mean, I think it's very difficult in this country to reconcile all of these things.
Yeah, excellent points, Melissa. Thanks so much for the call, and congratulations on the babies. Are they boys or girls? Or one?
Two boys.
God bless. Good for you.
Thanks so much. Okay. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your call.
And congratulations. Melissa brings up a couple of really important points. One, when we talk about equality, we have a tendency to want to paint everybody with the same brush. Pregnancy, for the most part, there's been a couple of, you know, experimental cases, happens only to women. And so what we're trying to do, or what the legislature has tried to do, is to shove it into a category that already exists instead of making a special category for women. The analogy is to bathroom equity. Women take longer in the bathroom than men. So is equity having the same number of stalls? No, equity is having more stalls. And so it's not a disability. It is a very natural thing that happens, and yet we don't quite know what to do with it. And as Melissa points out, a lot of it is that the society is promoting a certain type of family and still doesn't quite know, we still don't know quite what to do with women who have children and work in the workplace. And so she felt, even though she had a very accommodating employer, that she had to prove that she could still do the work, which is a tension that many of us have felt.
We have a email here from Stephanie who says, I think that the way that the Social Security Administration defines disability is a good metric to use. You must be completely unable to work for at least one full year to qualify for disability. Since pregnancy lasts only 9 months, it wouldn't qualify. Right. And then she says, my son works for UPS, like the woman who brought the suit that ended up at the Supreme Court. He was in a motorcycle accident last year, scraped and banged up, but nothing broken. The first week, he felt like he'd never get better. The second week, scrapes were healing and he was more mobile. He was still in pain. And then the third week, he saw the light at the end of the tunnel. So Stephanie's making the argument that, disability needs to be pretty specifically defined, and it needs to last for this particular period. The one year cutoff seems to be important to Stephanie.
But I see the loophole there, because yes, you're pregnant for 9 months, but then there is a period right afterward that you, for the most part, don't get up and go right back to work. So there really is about a year. When you're busy making another human and recovering and doing that. So even then, but again, the problem is, what about disability? The reason I got interested when I heard about Senator Duckworth is that when I was pregnant, I found out I was pregnant with Kelsey the same week I found out I had gotten a job as an associate dean. I've been associate dean twice. She was hard won. So, I mean, I was going to have her. We were going to have her. There was no question of that. And it wasn't an illness. I remember saying, this is not an illness. I can do this. And I can do this. I did do this.
You can be an associate dean and be pregnant with a
daughter. Now, again, I had a chair, so I could sit down. I mean, standing is one of the issues. I could sit down when I needed to sit down. But one of the things that really became very interesting is that I was surrounded by older men who in these administrative positions. And Kelsey, you met her, is 5'10". She was a big baby. I looked like a cruise ship after a while. And I noticed that men would be very uncomfortable. That's the tension that people are talking about. And they would look at me and they would say, when are you going home? And you know my sense of humor. I said, about 5-6 o'clock. Do you need to talk to me about something?
Need anything before?
And they would look at me like, no. And I realized they were disturbed by this, that this most traditional thing was making a statement that, yes, I am a female. Yes, I have a body. Yes, there's a human being in there. And yes, I can still do this work. And that they were having trouble. There was no reason for me to go home.
Now, that was 22 years ago. Is it your sense? I mean, you're still, at the University of Maryland. You're still, you've been in and out of associate deanships, and you're teaching, and you've got graduate students and fellow colleagues, who are your age and younger, some of whom are having babies. Do you think it's the culture has evolved at all?
Somewhat, but it's still a question. It's still rare to see a pregnant woman on campus, a student or a faculty member. I've had graduate students who have chosen, graduate students who work with me at the doctoral level, who have chosen to have a child, and the pressure that one particularly has gotten from her peers, not from faculty, is that, is this a smart decision? Do you really want to make that statement, which is what Melissa was saying? Do you really want to suggest that you're not as serious? So it's still very much in the culture.
Yeah, Melissa brings up this point about the different effects in the workplace that mm-hmm. parenthood has for men and for women. For men, it's often a career booster, and for women, it's often a career barrier because the employer says, well, she's pregnant, she's going to be all distracted, she's got this kid, she's not going to be dependable. But you tell if you're a man and you tell your boss that you've just become a father, you're stable, you're dependable, you're not one of these crazy single guys who's out there in the club until 3 o'clock every morning. You're going to be a more stable and a more valued employee.
It's an asset.
How does that culture change?
Well, notice the assumption that's inherent in there. The assumption is that guy is not going to be an active parent, which we know is changing. If the baby has a cold, it's going to be the mom who stays home with it. Only with that assumption do you keep this idea that for her, this is a liability, and for him, it is an asset.
Here's Lisa writing us on email. She says, I'm currently in my 11th week of maternity leave, and I'll be going back to work after 12 weeks, so she's got one more week. What I've learned is that parental leave is not a women's issue. It's a human and gender equality issue. When fathers don't have substantial paternity leave, it quickly sets up a reversion to antiquated gender roles, even for couples who wish to share parenting and domestic roles equally. When the mother's at home with the child during this intense transition period, and the father misses that important time to learn how to care for the child, it becomes difficult to truly divide the domestic and parenting labor even once the mother returns to work. I think in promoting maternity leave, we must promote paternity leave at the same time. That's a good point, Lisa, and thank you for that.
And the data supports her that if in countries where you have use it or lose it paternity leave, they have found that fathers continue to be more active in the life of the child.
Yeah, it always used to drive Linnell and I crazy, and we're the parents of a 29-year-old woman, so this was a long time ago, where people talked about stay-at-home mothers or full-time moms. Mm-hmm. You know, Linnell was a full-time mom when she was also a journalist for the Baltimore Sun and later as a senior editor at Johns Hopkins. I was a full-time dad when I was the music director of the Choral Arts Society and working here and et cetera. You're full-time at parenting, whether you've got a job or not. But notion that if you choose to stay home with your child as a man or a woman, and certainly fewer men are choosing that, there's no doubt about that, it's looked on by people in the workforce a little suspiciously.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, despite what we say about supporting the family and it being stability and security, the workplace increasingly is a pseudo-home. And you're supposed to choose that one over your family and your home. You're supposed to be loyal,
your coworkers are your family.
Is your family, and that doesn't mean that you don't like them quite a lot. But that idea that a family is a distraction, that if a woman has a quote a daycare problem, that really is a liability as opposed to the man having a daycare problem. When Kelsey was little, us being both academics, I started teaching on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and her dad taught on Tuesday, Thursday. So when she was sick, whoever wasn't teaching that day was the one. But notice, that's a highly privileged position to do that.
Sure.
Not every family can do that. We have not, the fact that we're the only post-industrial country that doesn't have a solution for daycare is related to this, that we really have not figured out what to do with women in the workplace, even though they're half of the workforce at this point.
And daycare and childcare is a huge barrier for many families to have both of the parents working. And that's always been the case. When we talk to the people at the Jane Addams Resource Center up in Park Heights, which is a job training program, they're teaching manufacturing skills, welding, that kind of thing. And they're placing people, and daycare for the children, childcare, is the number one barrier that a lot of those people, men and women, but mostly women, have to being able to accept these really good jobs that they are now trained to do.
It's extraordinarily expensive, because it's not subsidized in the way it really should be, because it's really education. But we start education at 5 or 6, and people who can afford it get quality daycare, and people who can't afford it get pretty awful daycare. And that doesn't make sense in a social development sense. I mean, these are little people that we should be growing. But again, we really are comfortable with the idea of the mom at home, despite what we say.
A report from the American Journal of Public Health released in 2015, so it's 3 years old or so, found that the number of men taking paternity leave has actually tripled over the last 2 decades. So there are more men doing this and getting with the program. So back in 1994, about 5,800 men took paternity leave, and it was 22,000 per month in 2015. So there's a lot more men getting into the rhythm of childcare and child and helping, than did before. Of course, and you're also, if you are able to be there for that period of time, it's a magical and wonderful period when the baby is, we referred to our daughter as the permanent guest. Once she showed up after about 2 or 3 weeks, we realized that this one, of all the people who've like crashed at our house over the years, she ain't leaving. She ain't going anywhere until she did. And then we were heartbroken.
but notice, I mean, if a father is taking care of his child, that makes him a wonderful guy. If the mom is taking care of her child, she's doing what she's supposed to do. That's the responsibility issue.
Karen in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I'm a nurse, and I was kind of fortunate in a way because I had my kids much later in life, like in my upper 30s, and I had my ex-husband.
Okay, Karen, we're going to have to maybe have you hang up and try back again, because we have a bad phone line, but I would love to talk to you. So if you wouldn't mind hanging up and trying again, Karen is a nurse who wants to talk about the experience that her coworkers have. And unfortunately, we just can't hear Karen, but please do call back. Let's try Sharon in Owings Mills. Sharon, welcome to the program. Thanks for your call.
Hi there. I have experienced somewhat of a positive situation recently, that I have a lot of pregnant coworkers or their wives are pregnant, and when it's the husband, they're taking maternity leave, and when it's a child that's sick, the man switches off and stays home, and it's not the woman that's always expected to do that. So I think that at least in the teaching profession here in Maryland, they're being understanding the employers about people taking off because they have a family, and they actually encourage it.
Well, thank you for that call, Sharon. I appreciate it. And Sherry, the differences in professions and the differences in the experiences is profound.
It's profound.
I mean, if you're working at T. Rowe Price, or if you're
an academic office job,
with BGE, or an academic job, you've got all sorts of options. If you're working at Target or Walmart, the economic impact of having to take time off from work is severe, and the struggle to have your child cared for is really tough.
And it gets at a different attitude toward labor. If you're a highly valued employee and they've invested a lot in your training, and you're not easily replaced, those are the jobs where they're going to invest in you in a number of ways, including maternity and maternity leave. If you're considered to be replaceable easily, if you're underskilled labor, then you see that you don't get those considerations.
Good. Karen is back with us, but Karen, I'm going to ask you to hold on. We got to take a break, but I will come back to you as soon as we are back here. Dr. Sherry Parks is on the faculty of the University of Maryland College Park. She is the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. We'll have more with Sherry Parks on this edition of Midday Culture Connections when we return from a break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland in College Park. And we're talking about pregnancy in the workplace and the difficulty that many women who are expecting children face in certain kinds of jobs. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and in the Twittersphere, you can find us @MiddayWIPR. Karen, let's try you again. Welcome back. Thanks for calling back. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. How is the connection now?
This is a lot better. Thank you.
Oh, good. I'm inside my building, so. Yeah, I was fortunate that I had my kids. I was older, and we were financially able for me to stay home for actually a number of years. And I was in a profession, nursing, that's very easy to come in and out of the workforce. But nowadays, you know, I work with a lot of young nurses, and I feel so bad for them. They're coming back after 6, 8, 12 weeks. Their bodies are barely healed. They barely formed a bond with their child. The kids just getting to the point where they're actually getting interesting. I'm not into newborns myself. I like those kids as they get older. And I just think that it's just so hard on families for them to have to come back in and work these long 12-hour shifts, which really end up being 13 or 14 hours with the transportation, and come home. And, you know, it just doesn't seem, there's something kind of a kilter about the whole thing to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for the call, Karen. I appreciate it. The Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993 said that some parents may be eligible for 12 weeks of leave. And Karen is saying 12 weeks just isn't enough. There are countries, Malaysia, I believe, mandates a year. Cuba mandates a year for maternity leave or parental leave. You know, it's certainly ample time to bond with your babies. But corporations and companies are going to say, look, we can't economically run our businesses if that's what's happening, if we have certain people coming in and out of the workforce for an entire year. But boy, finding that sweet spot, whether it's 12 weeks, 16 weeks, you know, 3 months, that's hard.
Well, it is hard. And emotionally, it is very difficult if women come back too early, because, I mean, they're distracted. They're worried about their babies. They miss them. It's not great for the babies. I'm not sure that it's actually as cost effective to have a highly distracted worker anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing, and you take a very close look at pop culture. It's interesting to me, the fact that women are in large measure going out of their way not to hide the fact that they're pregnant now. Mm-hmm. As the music director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society, we had what we called the dress, which was the maternity dress. And so whoever was pregnant needed to use that dress for the concerts, right? It's a black formal gown, you know, but it was like a tent, you know, and that dress just got passed around to everybody who needed it if they were pregnant for a particular gig. Now, I mean, you've got Beyonce, you've got Serena Williams, you've got people on covers of magazines proudly showing their tummies.
And there has been that progression. I mean, in 20, 30 years ago, you didn't say pregnant. It was considered, in the 50s, pregnant was a bad word. It was a naughty word. You said in a family way or has a bun in the oven. And the fashion reflected that. I mean, these huge clown-sized bows that really weren't hiding anything, or these, are you mentioned the tents, are the big pleats so that you were supposed to hide it. It was almost as if pregnancy was shameful, that you weren't supposed to say in polite society that at one point you had had sex and now you're growing a human. And now there's been this progression. And I think this affects attitudes. I mean, you've got celebrities now who are showing their baby bumps. I mean, it's now a news item, and are painting their baby, are certainly bearing, or their abdomens are and it's perceived as beautiful or sexy. And I think that has changed. You know, pregnancy is now out in the open, and maybe that will lead to more acceptance in other spaces.
Let's go back to the phones. Alex in Butchers Hill, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment actually kind of goes along with what the last woman said, but on the other side of things, where we're having our first kid, my wife is a nurse at Johns Hopkins, and we've just been talking to a lot of full-time nurses and all that, and they, you know, they might be able to take 12 weeks of FMLA, which is unpaid. And to me, that the foremost, you know, hospital institution in the country not offering paid maternity leave to their nursing staff is just absolutely ludicrous. I mean, there's one thing, you know, 12 weeks isn't enough to bond with your baby. It's another thing if you're not working for 12 weeks and not earning any money, and it's not like the nurses at Hopkins earn a ton of money as it is. But I'm just totally shocked by the sort of hypocrisy in you know, we're talking about health at a hospital, and yet these nurses don't get paid maternity leave.
So, I'm going to have to take your word for it, because I don't know the employment practices at Johns Hopkins Hospital, but you're saying that when you take maternity leave, there are no days, no weeks at all that are paid. Every inch of it is unpaid maternity leave?
As far as I know, and that's, but that is FMLA. You know, that's
The Family Medical Leave Act,
Is not guaranteed to have to be paid.
Right. I'm guessing that they probably can use whatever sick leave they have paid up, have saved up, and then FMLA kicks in. That's pretty constant. But your point still holds, is that you have to use your sick leave, and then you're on your own, which is a very stressful situation to not have income coming in.
Mm-hmm. At this point, Alex, what are your plans in terms of how much time off from work your wife is going to take once she delivers?
Well, it's complicated for us because she's also in school at the same time, and
it is complicated.
We really don't know. I mean, we're fortunate if she doesn't have to work, because I have a good enough salary that I can support us. But we're just the one family. I mean, the thing that she comes home with these stories all the time about. People who she works with who might be sick, who might be reaching the end of their FMLA, and they're asking other nurses to donate their PTO to one another.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah.
You're most desperate or whatever, and you're asking people to give their earned time off.
Yeah, PTO is paid time off, right? Well, I appreciate the call, Alex, and good luck with the baby. And by the way, I appreciate Alex's rhetorical device when he said we're expecting a baby. Mm-hmm. He didn't say we're pregnant. Mm-hmm. When my wife Linnell was pregnant with our daughter Miranda, it was in vogue in those days for men to say we're pregnant. And I always said, I ain't pregnant. I'm a lot of things. I've been accused of a lot of things in my life, justifiably. But being pregnant ain't one of them. Because Linnell was pregnant. I was along for the ride, and it was a beautiful ride. Charlie writes in and says, I'd like to address the issue of women having children they can't afford. I don't understand the thinking that if you have multiple children and you can't afford them, government should pay for their care. It's unfair to the women as well, because they can't move forward in their own careers and can't afford daycare. The difficulty for me is this sounds so harsh, but I need to hear a really good discussion to help resolve this. So there are people who make decisions to have fewer children or no children at all because they're concerned about raising babies, and raising babies is expensive.
It's very expensive, and the model has flipped. I mean, when you had an agrarian society, having children was a way to get wealth. Most of us do not have their children out hoeing the back 40. So children, and this can be insulting, children are extremely expensive hobbies. I mean, you have them only. I ask my students, why did your parents have you, when we're talking about that, and they have to think, and I, because the only reason to have a child is because you love them. They don't generate income for the most part. And so the economic model has flipped. Our attitudes haven't flipped. The society really hasn't decided what to do with children and families.
Yeah. But, you know, I know in my case, we made a decision to only have one child because it was so expensive at the time. I'm a musician. My wife's a writer. We weren't going to be making a whole lot of money and never did make a whole lot of money. And so we thought we can't afford two. Or three, we can only afford one. And it was a decision that was based largely on economics, because we have concerns, and you have the same situation, having an only child. Yeah. We have concerns that as we reach our decrepitude, the burden of this is going to fall on just her. Yeah. I mean, you know, I got four brothers, so as our parents have aged, you know, we can spread the pain around. Clara in Timonium, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thanks for taking me, because I'm going to kind of go off in a different direction. My twins are 25 now, so I've been through the whole gamut. And fortunately, work in IT, so I was often able to arrange or find jobs where I could work out of the house. And while I found it very valuable to be able to do that when they were infants and toddlers, honestly, the most valuable time in terms of communicating with them and their development was when they were in middle school. Being able to be home when they got home from school made such a profound difference in our overall life that it was just amazing. They'd get in, and the folks I work with used to find it amusing that I kind of blanked out debriefing time between 3 and 3:30. And I'd just sit with them and let them tell me what happened. Just whatever went on in school, and I heard stories that I never would have heard if I'd had to wait till 5 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And they defused, so the rest of the evening was so much more relaxed.
Yeah,
they
could
concentrate on their homework.
Yeah, thanks for that comment, Claire. Of course, you know, if we could just hover over our children at every stage of their lives, things would be great. I mean, I'm sure my daughter would have loved some help writing term papers in graduate school. But Claire makes a point. Middle school is a tough time.
Well, and she makes the larger point is that parenting is serious business. I mean, one of the reasons I stepped away from being associate dean the first time is that Kelsey needed me more at 5 or 6 than she did at 2. That was where she was really active. And
again, you had the wherewithal to be able to do that.
Right.
You could control that.
Right.
Yeah.
But then we asked, why do we have these societal problems later when we haven't made arrangements for our children, the society?
Yeah. We've talked about this on this show before. Yeah. I mean, when we want to address the violence that we have in the city of Baltimore, look at the city of New York, who has a much lower murder rate, and look at the fact that every 3-year-old in all 5 boroughs goes to pre-K, goes to a place where there is an adult, a trained adult. They get good food, they get naps, they get the rest they need, they get the socialization they need, and they start learning their numbers and their colors so that by the time they go to kindergarten, they've got a leg up.
And they're on their way.
They spend a lot of money, but, you know, they have a murder rate I think is reflective directly of that kind of policy.
And I'm sure you've said in other shows, it's actually cheaper to put the money in earlier than it is later.
Yeah. We have a bunch of other calls, and we don't have any time to get to them. I very much appreciate everybody who chimed in. We're very grateful for that. Sorry I couldn't get to everybody. But Sherry Parks, that's all for today, and we shall see you the next time.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks joins us on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. She's an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with the Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with the author of a new biography of an iconic folk legend. David Yaffe joins me to talk about Reckless Daughter. That's his Portrait of Joni Mitchell. That's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. Stay tuned at the top of the hour. Out of the Blocks with Aaron Henkin is on the way. That's on tap right after the hour's headlines from NPR. I appreciate you listening. I'm Tom Hall on behalf of the entire Midday team. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.